Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
The modern world puts us to sleep. How can we wake ourselves up?
Walter Benjamin, re-enchanting the world.
Benjamin's right. Modernity is terrible, the world is disenchanted, art has lost its magic, and we're all sleepwalking through life.
But there are new forms of enchantment. Art is for everyone, and we can shock ourselves awake. Benjamin said that too.
So will the real Benjamin please stand up?
I wonder if enjoyment of the world of images is not fed by a somber defiance of knowledge.
Our guest is Margaret Cohen, author of Profane Illumination, Walter Benjamin and the Paris of Surrealist Revolution.
Walter Benjamin and the Reenchanted World.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. In the age of capitalism and technology, has the world lost its magic?
Are we all just sleepwalking through life?
Can art wake us up and re-enchant the world?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from our respective shelters in place via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about Walter Benjamin and the re-enchantment of the world.
Ah, that guy was so interesting. German-Jewish thinker from the early 20th century, died tragically. Fascinating ideas about Marxism, modernity, mysticism.
And I really like his ideas about disenchantment. He showed us how bleak life has become in the modern world. Corporate greed, consumerism, capitalism.
Ah, you're such a pessimist, Ray. I mean, modernity has also given us democracy. Literacy across the globe. Longer, healthier lives.
Okay, fine, Josh. So we live a little bit longer, we read a little bit more, and we get to vote. Big deal. Democracy is just an illusion that makes us think we have some say in how things go. Our long lives are full of alienation and futility. We're all just cogs in the capitalist machine.
I don't know. I'm not sure we're totally hopeless. Think about civil rights, Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, gay marriage. Sometimes things actually change. And you know what, Ray? I think modern technology's actually helped that to happen.
I suppose it's better than nothing. But all of that just seems like rearranging the deck chairs on the capitalist Titanic.
Capitalist Titanic? What are you talking about?
Okay, sure. Social progress is good, but the planet is dying thanks to that technology that you're so excited about. And the profits aren't even going to the people. They're going to the richest 1%. That's what modernity is really about.
Ah, come on, Ray. I mean, there's always been inequality and exploitation. Would you rather live in the feudal age or maybe the state of nature? I don't think things are worse today than they were back then.
You're saying they're better?
Well, at least we have modern art.
Oh, modern art? How's that supposed to solve the problem of modern life?
Well, that's actually one of Benjamin's coolest ideas. He thought some forms of modern art, like surrealism, can actually re-enchant the world. They can help us see everyday life as full of mystery and wonder, even the most mundane things like a bowler hat, a pipe, or a clock.
Yeah, I like the kind of art that feeds the resistance. Art that's unsettling and jarring and shocks us out of our complacency.
But Benjamin says art does that too, at least the modern kind. I mean, you can't be a sleepwalker if you're listening to Philip Glass all day.
Okay, fine. At least this Titanic has avant-garde deck chairs. Too bad you can't actually sit on them.
Well, it sounds like we need to learn more about Benjamin. So, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to do just that. She files this report.
In an effort to understand the life of Walter Benjamin, I searched for movies about him that any plebe could understand. But instead of a Hollywood biopic, I found not one, but two operas about this doomed philosopher's life. One is called Benjamin. Another is Shadow Time.
Is it possible to forget without remembering? that one has forgotten.
I listened through it, but still can only describe the plot because there are summaries online. Not because I understand it. It seems all over the place. Like, in one scene, Benjamin is interrogated by masked figures. Karl Marx and Groucho Marx taunt him about the nature of memory. Joan of Arc worries about the fate of history, and Albert Einstein asks, "What time is it now?"
What time is it?
It's trippy, surreal, and dizzying, not unlike Benjamin himself.
He's really a strange kettle of fish.
Howard Eiland teaches literature at MIT and has been working on Benjamin since the 1980s. He says Benjamin is an eclectic and, yes, difficult writer.
So difficult to translate. Certain sentences just had me mind-boggled for days on end.
And his life was also difficult, though it wasn't always that way. Benjamin was born in 1892 into a prosperous German-Jewish family in Berlin. His dad was a well-to-do antique dealer who passed a zeal for bookstores and collecting onto his son. Then, after World War I, Germany went into a depression.
His father put his foot down and said, "Walter, you got to get a job," and he suggested getting a job in a bank, which showed how little he knew his son.
Benjamin instead went on a quest to get a job in academia, but Eiland says his dissertation at the University of Frankfurt was rejected because it was considered too complicated.
And when that failed in 1925, he then turned to the world of journalism, and I think that was a decisive moment in his life because it enabled him to write about a whole range of things.
In 1927, Benjamin went to Moscow for 2 months to visit a girlfriend. This was after Lenin had died.
And there was an extraordinary sense of experiment going on in Moscow, and it was quite an experience for him.
He eventually returned to Germany, but was forced to leave when the Nazis came to power in 1933. He went to the island of Ibiza, another decisive moment in his life.
There he experienced a kind of rebirth of physical life. And he wrote a whole series of articles about what he called the mimetic capacity, the capacity that he thinks most of us have lost, a capacity to imitate things, to imitate the motions of animals, to imitate the motions of the stars.
Benjamin is constantly drawn to what has disappeared or is at the brink of disappearing, says writer and editor Adam Kirsch. For Benjamin and many Jewish intellectuals at the time, the world was filled with despair.
He had seen fascism take over Germany, which had once been thought of as the most enlightened country in Europe and specifically the best country for Jews in Europe. And he, like many other people, saw democracy and capitalism as on the road to failure.
In 1935, Benjamin wrote The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, a critique of capitalism and one of his most well-known pieces.
Where he talks about how the sort of transformation of the way people consume art from individual objects that have a sort of magical status, like a painting, to mass media, like newspapers and magazines and movies and radio.
Benjamin spent the last years of his life in France. When Germany invaded in 1940, he was one of millions of people trying to escape. He reached the border between Spain and France, but the border was closed, and in his despair, he overdosed on morphine.
And then as it turned out, the next day, the border was reopened, and the other people in his group managed to cross over. He didn't. He had despaired at the wrong moment.
A few months before he died, Benjamin wrote Theses on the Philosophy of History, his final work. In this essay, he writes,
"There is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism."
And in some ways, his life is that document. But as Benjamin also says,
"The past can be seen only as an image, which flashes up at the instant when it can be recognized, and is never seen again."
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that great report, Holly. That's really fascinating. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about Walter Benjamin and the Reenchantment of the World.
And we're joined now by Margaret Cohen, professor of French language, literature, and civilization at Stanford University, and author of Profane Illumination, Walter Benjamin and the Paris of Surrealist Revolution. Margaret, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, it's great to be here with you.
So Margaret, by the way, I should say, Margaret is my fellow Andrew B. Hammond chair of French literature, language, and civilization at Stanford. So it's a particular pleasure to have you here. And Margaret, you've written brilliantly on lots of topics from novels to oceans. So what was it about Benjamin in particular that piqued your interest?
So Benjamin's a super eclectic thinker, and he is interested in the outmoded, in garbage, in the odds and ends of things. And at the same time, he's got a very strong avant-garde commitment. And I think this spoke to me personally, because I grew up in a household where my parents were kind of like Adorno. They hated mass culture, and I wasn't allowed to watch TV, and I was taken to Pierre Boulez concerts, and avant-garde cinema from the Soviet period was inflicted on me. And I respected that aesthetic, but I also wanted some way to return to mass culture, and Benjamin seemed to offer that to me.
So Josh and I were arguing earlier about whether the modern world is disenchanted. And I said, look, things are pretty bleak. And Josh said, no, it's not all doom and gloom. So what do you think Benjamin would say?
Well, I guess, do you have a definition of disenchantment that you're working with?
No, I was hoping you could tell us what it meant.
I think Benjamin's definition of disenchantment comes out of Max Weber, who was a very important founder of sociology, as you know, and specifically from a lecture called Science as Vocation in 1918, which was published in 1922, where he coined a phrase which has become widespread, the disenchantment of the world. And I actually use this in a class I just taught on Gothic literature, so I have the quote in front of me. He says, there are no mysterious incalculable forces that come into play, but rather one can in principle master all things by calculation. This means that the world is disenchanted. One need no longer have recourse to magical means in order to master or implore the spirits. Technical means and calculation perform this service. And I think this is what Benjamin would have understood by disenchantment.
So it sounds like disenchantment is about not using magical thinking to understand the world, but instead thinking that everything is technologically in your grasp. Is that a good paraphrase?
Yes, technology, calculation. He also associates that with intellectualization, with reason. He associates that with bureaucracy, which is hardly rational, but a bunch of things get drawn together there in terms of mechanisms of modern society. And I think Benjamin would say, society is disenchanted, but it also performs in ways that are quite in contradiction with that. And he's interested, for example, in Marx and Marx's thinking that shows the ways in which society is completely mystified, even as it is disenchanted.
That's really interesting, right? Because you've got these sort of two strands of disenchantment, one of which is the kind of thing you were just talking about, right? You know, we used to think rainbows were a god, and then at least a sign from God, and now they're just prismatic refractions. So science has taken over in the world of belief, at least heavily. And then there's the area of practices, right, where faith kind of beats a retreat from the public sphere, and it's not what dominates our legal system, our marriage system that much, our education system. But what you're saying, Margaret, is Benjamin gets all that, sees all that, worries about it, but he also thinks the modern world has its own kinds of secret enchantments.
Yeah, absolutely. And so he goes back to Marx. He's very interested, for example, in a concept that Marx has of the phantasmagoria, which is a way that Marx writes about the mystifications of capitalist society and the way in which social relations between people become what one of Benjamin's contemporaries, Georg Lukács, will call reified. We have relations between people take the form of relations between things, and then those things appear as spectacles that they desire, whether they're commodities, whether they are celebrities. So Benjamin, he plucks out of Marx those kinds of concepts that talk about a certain kind of magic that continues in modernity.
Right. So how would you say that Marx's concept of enchantment relates to Benjamin's?
Well, Marx is very uncomfortable with it, and he does not really pursue it. It exists more in the realm of metaphor than as something that Marx works through. And one of the very influential works for me was a work by Louis Althusser, Reading Capital, where Althusser argues that metaphors in thinkers are often the marks of concepts that have not yet been articulated. So what Marx does with the world of dream, with the world of enchantment, with mesmerism, is fascinating to Benjamin, and Benjamin wants to conceptualize how modernity has its own magic as well, and how that magic, which is a source of mystification, could potentially then be thought of as a source of redemptive energy.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about Walter Benjamin with Margaret Cohen from Stanford University.
Is the modern world disenchanted? Are we all just rats running on a capitalist wheel? Or is there hope for a better kind of life?
Benjamin, disenchantment and reenchantment. When Philosophy Talk continues. Are we all just bionic strumpets only worth a dime? Or is there hope for a better life? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about Walter Benjamin and the Reenchantment of the World with Margaret Cohen from Stanford University, author of Profane Illumination.
With shelter in place still in effect, we're pre-recording this episode and unfortunately can't take your calls. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or become a subscriber and join the conversation on our blog at philosophytalk.org.
So, Margaret, earlier we were saying that Benjamin sees the modern world as disenchanted. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, or is it more complicated than that?
Both. Benjamin is a dialectical thinker, so he is interested in how the good thing is also the bad thing, but then there's a way to get beyond that. And he's very interested in aesthetics as a place, or as a domain, I should say, where expressivity and concepts and subject and object meet. And he is throughout his work interested in the redemptive possibilities that aesthetics can offer for forms of experience that would complicate calculation and rationalization and enrich us and potentially encourage us to some sort of a revolt against the capitalist conditions that oppress us.
Okay, so it sounds like disenchantment is good if it sort of encourages us to revolt against capitalism. What's bad about it?
What's bad about it is that it suppresses humanity. Benjamin, in his famous work of art in the Age of Technological Reproducibility essay, discusses the way the worker on the assembly line becomes mechanized almost as a cog in a machine and loses the capacity to recognize him or herself or their self as a subject. And so Benjamin wants workers to be, and all of us, to be able to reclaim our humanity, which disenchantment threatens.
I kind of have a little bit of puzzlement about that essay, actually, because I think I'm not so persuaded that enchantment is as great as Benjamin makes it out to be. So, like, enchanted art seems really bougie, for instance. It's all about like having a painting that like everybody wants the object of the painting. You can't just have posters of it in your room because like it doesn't have the aura. Is that really how we want to relate to our humanity? Like, isn't that just another power structure?
Yes, completely. And for Benjamin, that concept of art goes back to antiquity and to the notion of art as a sacred experience where the perceiver and the art object are joined together with a sense of presence. And in fact, Benjamin is thinking in a very much in the spirit, anti-bougie spirit that you're suggesting, about how new media could break up that magic and that mystery. So he uses the concept of aura, which has been lost in modernity. And he thinks about how film, which was a new media of his time, were in the 1920s, 1930s, could promote a different type of viewership, which has the potential to disrupt the opiate of aura, which would be what he calls reception in a state of distraction.
Yeah, I mean, that is such a powerful essay, right? I mean, that does seem like a place. I think it's very much in line with what Ray was saying. It's a place where Benjamin, for the most part, seems to be suggesting that we need a new kind of art, just as you're saying, Margaret. We need the kind that doesn't depend on aura and enchantment, but, you know, kind of disenchants the aesthetic. It makes it more democratic. So anyone can go see a movie. Anyone can be a critic of a movie. Anyone can make a Dada-style artwork. You could even write. You could even make your own art. And just as you were saying, Margaret, you can make these new forms of art that wake people up. So is there any downside to this? Because occasionally you get the feeling that nonetheless, Benjamin is saying, I really want this more political art, this more democratic art. But maybe we've also lost something along the way.
Yeah, he uses the concept of Janus space at one point in one of his essays. And Benjamin is always looking back to look forward and looking forward to look back. I'm going to take a swerve, if you don't mind, through Benjamin's intellectual influences, which may be helpful to understanding his ambivalence. So Benjamin right. is super influenced by Brecht. And in fact, writes about him and he loves the Brechtian idea of critique, of getting the viewer involved, of breaking the fourth wall. And at the same time, Benjamin is super influenced by a major thinker in Jewish spiritualism, Gershom Scholem, and notably his book on Kabbalah and major trends in Jewish mysticism. And Benjamin is interested in the Jewish mystical idea through Kabbalah that God's attributes have been shattered and are spread around the world, and that the task of the person, the ethical person, is tikkun olam, is to go put together these pieces, these shards of the shattered vessels. You cannot think of anything more anti-Brechtian than this Scholem mysticism. And then, of course, as I've written about, Benjamin is also influenced by Surrealism, which seeks to bring desire into deadened capitalist modernity.
I'm dying to hear you talk about Surrealism, but I want to bring in here, before we get to that, an email that we received from Alfredo, who lives in Aix-en-Provence, and says, "I'm lucky enough to live 10 minutes away from the Carrière de Lumière here in Les Baux de Provence, a giant limestone quarry against whose walls are projected works of great painters. And while Benjamin's aesthetic thinking will always have me wishing I could admire Dalí's melting clocks on their original canvas, I believe this exhibition has done an admirable job of preserving their aura. Truly enchanting." So that's interesting. So that's someone who thinks, and you know, Benjamin says, once you can reproduce an artwork a million times, posters, lithographs, whatever, its aura has gone. But Alfredo says, no, I actually experienced the aura even in this mechanically reproduced form. What do you think about that, Margaret?
I think we should come up with a different term. And I don't know what that term is, but I think there is a magic to technology that we experience, and that has to do with something of its counterintuitive and anti-common sense quality, as well as its ability to entrance us. And so I don't know. Maybe you guys have an idea. I've taught Benjamin many times, and we look for this. What else could we say for, you know, the work of art in the age of technological reproduction that is doing justice to its magic, but that is not the religious aura?
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Walter Benjamin and the Reenchantment of the World with Margaret Cohen from Stanford University.
Margaret, I wanted to pick up on something that Josh said earlier, which I wasn't sure about, which was this thing about the democratization of art. So I was curious both about how much Benjamin sort of was interested in that, and also like a little bit skeptical that anyone can make a film. You need quite a lot of equipment. So I guess like I want to know both like how supportive of it was Benjamin and how really possible is it?
So Benjamin was not too interested in empowering people as art makers. Benjamin really was a critic, and for him, the highest work was the work of criticism. So he was interested in empowering people as critics. And I think if you look at, for example, what he admired about surrealism, it wasn't that we could all go out and make collages to disagree with you, Josh. It was that it would enable us to turn our experience of the tawdry, banal, he uses the example of railway journeys in proletarian quarters on the edges of suburbs, when cities that are aging, into potentially moments of potential and possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I was just picking up on a little throwaway remark in that essay about Dada, but I absolutely take your point. It, mostly what he's interested in is our experience as consumers of surrealism and the way in which, as you say, surrealism transforms our experience, right? One of the problems with modernity is that it impoverishes our experience, Benjamin thinks, right? It takes away that lovely German word, Erfahrung, right? We don't have full lived experience where we're just sleepwalking through our lives. But if you can have a surrealist vision of the world, suddenly everything comes to life. And suddenly buildings are eloquent. They're full of these secrets, this the hidden depths in posters, petrol pumps, or gas pumps, I guess we would say here. That's one of my favorite examples. How's that supposed to work, Margaret? Like what is a surrealist vision show us that's hidden in the world we don't normally see?
Surrealism is looking for, I guess what Benjamin would call chips of now time, and this is to go back to the Kabbalah, moments that are fraught with potential to break the banality of bourgeois life, to put us in touch with our own desires, but also the desires of others, and in that way to inspire social change. And it sounds very utopian, but and I think utopian thinking is endemic and part of Europe in the interwar years, when you have to imagine that politically the situation is getting bleaker and bleaker by the year. And yet I think it also is empowering in terms of enabling us as sensuous presences to re-inject ourselves into the world around us. So for the surrealist, that pathway can be a sense of coincidence. It can be, they love chance meetings that break open habit. So the destruction of habit is very important to them. It can be something as surprising as a quote that sort of strikes you at the right moment. I guess time is really important too. You know that the surrealists are looking to activate time as opening toward the future and with a sense of potency.
Right. So I wonder if there are other opportunities to find sort of this enchantment in the everyday. I remember Benjamin having this thing about gas pumps looking like gods. Like are there like other artistic traditions that are inspiring besides surrealism?
For Benjamin, I'm now scrolling through my Rolodex. I mean, his great influence is, of course, Charles Baudelaire. But, you know, that goes to surrealism. And Baudelaire, he sees as the poet of the city who finds in the most seemingly revolting aspects of modern life, such as a cadaver rotting on a street, a chance to transform that into something aesthetic, and through the mediation of aesthetics, to create a sense of plenitude out of that.
Yeah, I think of a lovely line he has about Baudelaire, where Benjamin talks about, he says that Baudelaire talks about the price for which the sensation of the modern age may be had, the disintegration of the aura and the experience of shock. So what about that? He seems to be saying that on the one hand, you have the surrealists who are discovering this hidden mystery in the built environment, in gas pumps, in buildings, posters, and so on. And on the other hand, you have shock experience. So you have an aesthetic of shock where the poetry is jarring. It's hard, as you were saying, Margaret, you know, you might have a poem about a dead body or something like that. And that breaks the aura. It breaks a certain old way of doing business in art, but it brings about something really important, which allows us to wake up and have full experience again in a world that's disenchanted.
And I think another influence, yes, Josh, I agree 100%. And another influence to bring in, and I think which takes us maybe from Baudelaire, who remains in the domain of seeking the beautiful would be the Freudian influence, because Benjamin is interested, as are the surrealists, in accessing the repressed of individuals, but also the repressed of the collective. So Benjamin thinks about collective experience as potentially modeled on Freud's notion of the psyche, and trying to uncover, say, for example, the work that went into the petrol pump, or trying to put us in touch with the humanity that's hidden beneath the surface, I think is a kind of Benjaminian way to take surrealism and Marxism and try to fuse them. And then I guess one more influence to throw in is Proust, and the importance of sensuous experience itself as bearing the trace of time and collapsing the distinction between past, future, and present. So Benjamin, again, wants to take that to collective experience, to joining people together in some acts of resistance to rising fascism, for example.
Anyone who loves Proust can't be all bad, right? Can you say a little bit about the arcades? Obviously, Benjamin was famous for the arcades project that he was writing. How does this apply there? These passages in Paris, these commercial sites, what did he see in those that had to do with sort of the ghosts of our unconscious fears and desires?
Oh, it's such a rich and wonderful question. I mean, he entitled a 3,000 page collection of notes that were never, you know, he never was able to draw together in his lifetime. The arcades was about the Paris arcades. Yeah, so the arcades similarly are both the expression of a dreaming collective and yet have the possibility of reawakening. They were the first shopping malls, I suppose we could say, which were built in the 1840s or going back to the 1830s in Paris to protect strollers with leisure from the bad weather. As any of you who spend time in Paris knows, it's pretty bad weather a lot of the time, and the streets then were not paved, so it was really bad for your shoes. And they put out commodity society for you as a dream, and as something extremely alluring. And for Benjamin, the arcades were the site for the display of the commodity fetish as an alluring dream. And he's writing at a moment when some of the first arcades are being destroyed. So he's interested in both their beauty and their sort of a nostalgic appreciation of them. And then he's interested in understanding what are the mechanisms of commodity fetishism. Why do we think that if we buy this umbrella or that handbag, we will in some way be better? And I think that understanding the mechanism of commodity fetishism is a challenge which has only gotten more urgent in our society, which is so utterly saturated by the commodity in all areas that we need to disenchant it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the life and thought of Walter Benjamin with Margaret Cohen from Stanford University.
What can Benjamin tell us about life in the 21st century? What would he think about Facebook, smartphones, and Zoom? Is enchantment still possible in today's distracted times?
From distraction to wonder, when Philosophy Talk continues. This is a modern world. This is a modern world. This is the modern world. So where's the magic, the wonder, the enchantment? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Margaret Cohen from Stanford University, and we're thinking about Walter Benjamin and re-enchanting the world.
So Margaret, just before the break, you were talking really eloquently about the residue of Benjamin in today's 21st century world, how certain things he was talking about have just become more stark. And that brings me to an email we received from Nadim in Portland, Oregon. Nadim says, if the industrial and digital era brought disenchantment in people's life, then why are most urban dwellers on social platforms and finding connections? So I guess the question Is there potentially a source of re-enchantment in modern technology?
Whoa. I would have answered this very differently in January 2020 from June 2020. I think in January 2020, I would have said that there's a lot of potential in these platforms to make connections and break some of the bonds of habit and structures and pointed to uses of social media for potentially or social organization. I think in June 2020, having come out of a quarter of Zoom teaching and seeing how much university life depends on presence, as well as every other aspect of social life, I would say we got to be really careful. And digital life is a supplement, but it is not a replacement.
Right. So actually, this makes me wonder about sort of what it makes something enchanted. I know you gave us that definition at the beginning of the show, but one kind of view I could have about digital technologies is that they can be either enchanted or disenchanted. And this seems sort of to fit with Benjamin's line of thinking that like you can find enchantment in the modern world, but it depends on sort of social settings. So if you're living a rich life where you're surrounded by others and using digital technologies as a supplement, maybe they could be enchanted. And if you're living a life where your only connection to others, maybe they're not so enchanted. Is that an option in the space of ideas? Do you think it's a right option?
I would agree with you. And I think it's maybe a good moment to introduce another notion that Benjamin coins in his essay on surrealism, which is quite fascinating, the notion of profane illumination.
That's and the title by of your illumination, book, right?
So by illumination, he uses a word which in German means spiritual awakening rather than enlightenment in the sense of the 18th century enlightenment. And for Benjamin, profane illumination has the ability to bring together what he calls the image sphere and the body sphere. And I feel that this sense of profane illumination as conjoining image and body is something which we have really lost in the COVID moment and which may perhaps be mediated through these digital technologies. But I think that profane illumination and enchantment may now have shifted, I guess I'm saying, and that presence may be more important to it than one might have thought beforehand.
What about some other features of Benjamin that might still be relevant or even more relevant? You talked about commodity fetishism a moment ago. What about his worry in the essay on technological reproducibility of art about the danger of mass media? He's celebrating the possibilities of mass media to do good political work, but he's also worried. He has that line, "The star and the dictator emerge victorious," which I just feel like it's pretty prophetic of our moment. What do you think about that kind of thing having relevance today?
Yeah, I think the dangers of mechanical or technological reproducibility and to not sort of divert this show into a discussion of he who shall not be named, but the way in which the idea of fake news and it's all ideology separate us from truth is really extremely troubling. And I think that COVID-19 has been a wake up to say, well, no. And maybe this is the disenchantment of the world reappearing in a strange form as a potential for enchantment. You know, disease and the body are real and fake news cannot suppress it. And we now have to deal with reimagining and reinventing the world in light of that. So I guess the image I have is of that virus, like the image of that virus, you know?
Right. So what would Benjamin say about reshaping our material circumstances? Like, I think I'm getting what he's saying about shaping our ideological circumstances. Do we need to do more work, according to Benjamin, on the side of like the body?
We certainly do. And we also, to return to his last work, which is extraordinarily powerful, the thesis on the philosophy of history, we need to snatch memories as they're being destroyed from the jaws of the victors. I'm mixing up metaphors here now. But his idea is that historical urgency is and reclaiming the past from the dominant narrative is an essential work. And I think that at the moment in the US, we're seeing how a lot of factors are coming together to draw people's attention to Black Lives Matter, to the killing, you know, to the way in which Black Americans have been discriminated against over 200 or 400 years, actually. And that the return of the body, it seems to me there's something going on with reclaiming historical memory from being erased that is very much tied to the body as being exposed and that we can't hide behind social media. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. But it raises a broader question for me about Benjamin, which is, how much hope does he have in our capacity to make those kinds of change? Because on the one hand, I love what he has to say in the kind of Brechtian spirit about, you know, artworks that wake us up. I think today in today's context of Spike Lee, these Brechtian films, they're for mass audiences and they get us to wake up. And that seems sort of hopeful that maybe we can change things. On the other hand, I think of the other side of Benjamin where, you know, he talks about history as a single catastrophe which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage, right? And it seems at times as though the only hope is messianic hope, or the only hope, it's not coming from us. Salvation can only come from outside because really there's not much we can do. Where do you stand on this, Margaret? Do you think Benjamin is offering us resources to make change as human beings?
Gosh, it just depends what mood you're in, you know? What day is it? But yeah, I think like the statue smashing that's going on now of Confederate icons or people who were involved with slavery would be an example for Benjamin of empowerment. I think at the same time, we are in an extraordinarily dark world, and the ability not to be able to assemble as a collectivity would lead to a strand of messianic thinking that the things have to get, I mean, there's a strand of messianic Judaism, which is an antinomian strain, which says the Messiah will only come when things get so bad that the world is totally sunken and fallen. And therefore, this sect went about doing evil things in order to bring about redemption. I mean, there's also that side to our world. So I don't know. It really depends what day it is.
So one thing that I've noticed standing in for messianic thinking on like a lot of the left is this idea of the revolution. Like when the revolution comes, then our problems will kind of magically be solved. Is that a kind of re-enchantment? Is that like a kind that we should be enthusiastic about?
So I think the revolution kind of disappeared with the 21st century. Maybe we're reading different leftist thinkers. You know, I think a problem that Benjamin does not speak about at all, which for me does tie together the sphere of the body and the image sphere, is the environment. For Benjamin, technology is a tool, and a tool potentially of liberation, or as you were saying, Ray, it can do good things, it can do bad things, but he does not think of technology itself as destroying the planet. But if you follow on Instagram, different environmental photographers who are trying to raise awareness about climate change, there's nothing more charismatic than a sea otter, or nothing more disturbing than a graph of ice melt, you know, in the Arctic. And yet, is that just one more kind of consumable moment? Does that actually make a change in your daily life? How do we get involved in a way where we can contend with structures at a planetary level? I think that maybe you got to have Brecht and surrealism together. You know, you certainly need to awaken.
Well, on that note, Margaret, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been an enchanting and an awakening conversation.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure.
Our guest has been Margaret Cohen, Professor of French Language, Literature, and Civilization at Stanford University, my fellow Andrew B. Hammond Professor, author of Profane Illumination, Walter Benjamin, and the Paris of Surrealist Revolution. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
I am honestly not sure how much hope I have for the modern world right now. I'd like to be optimistic, and I'd like to think that, you know, environmental photography and statue smashing are going to save us from our problems. And I can't quite bring myself to believe it, but I still think that, like, Benjamin is worth reading while the world burns, at least.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I love about him is that he combines that hard-bitten realism with a sense that maybe we're not completely doomed. Maybe certain forms of thinking, certain forms of action, certain forms of art can help us. And if not, maybe the Messiah will save us.
Hopefully
maybe
the
revolution will save us. Hopefully the revolution. And this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog. Now, a man whose speed is always enchanting, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I came across notices for a 2014 San Francisco City Lights sponsored tribute to Walter Benjamin. There were lectures and seminars around the city over a week, including one called The Politics of Memory, which struck me as a very Benjamin kind of topic. I clicked on a link and was taken to a website for an Indonesian poker casino. Well, the link had expired, of course, the event being 6 years gone, which also seemed very Benjamin. He lived in the shadow of what was gone. Born into the 20th century, his was a world rent by World War. Social upheaval, Darwin, Freud, and Marx, their wicked offspring, fascism and communism. Also trains, planes, cars, movies, radio, the gleaming hulk of the modern. Benjamin spent his life curating memories and history to keep a foundation in the chaos. A word often used to describe Benjamin, haunted. Wrestling with the ghosts of the past, he wound up taking his own life when he concluded he would not be able to escape the clutches of the Nazis. We now know he might have been wrong, but that's easy to say in the future. And if there's a connection between Walter Benjamin and Indonesian poker, well, only the future can find it. Armed with irony, a sense of the absurd, and judicious use of Wikipedia, which, you know, is something Benjamin could have invented. I first came to Benjamin through a book about his radio work. None of his recordings survived, just texts. This also seems very Benjamin. This was in the early days of radio, in the late days of the Weimar Republic. He came to radio through his work as a freelance writer, which was his career after his thesis was rejected by the University of Frankfurt. A comfortable life as a teacher and thinker denied him, though of course the Nazis might have taken it from him anyway. He had to live by his wits. He found himself writing feature articles, usually about the world around us, city life, factories, department stores, flea markets. In that process, helping to create the role of the culture critic, a kind of public intellectual. He had a cult following. Bertolt Brecht was a fan, but nothing he ever wrote ever became what we might call viral today. And radio was a part of all that. As a broadcaster, he did think pieces, memory pieces, even pieces specifically for children. He wrote about the big noses of Berliners. He did jokes and riddles explaining how they work, pieces on slang, on gypsies, and con men. He told funny stories about dogs. When the radio work dried up and he was forced to move to France, he continued his eclectic pursuits. He embarked on a book, never finished, about the arcades in Paris, glass-covered promenades from the time of Baudelaire, for shopping and strolling, long gone by the time Benjamin arrived. But he hoped to preserve their flavor and the spirit of the flaneur, the boulevardier, the dandy in spats, hat and cane, strolling down the promenade, observing, amused, in the world but not of it. He wrote about Moscow, hashish, language. He championed Kafka and Brecht. And he was also assembling his personal archive. He himself was always on the move, so he had pieces of it scattered among his friends, old scraps of paper in which he scribbled notes, each labeled. Fancy notebooks, Russian toys, manuscripts, stamps, coins. It all seems part of an effort to give himself weight and credence and to gather evidence. He straddled surrealism and dialectical materialism. Who else did that? Caught between Dada and a hard place, he became a search engine with a point of view, a chronicler, a rag picker, the keeper of a roadside attraction, a database, a one-man museum with commentary. If he had come across the link that led from him to Indonesian poker, he might have taken up poker and moved to Vegas, until his luck ran out. Or he may have written a book on Indonesian puppetry, and then moved on to look at the haunted tropes of our time, ringtones, emojis, the effect of corruption on plague control. Who knows? As he once wrote about history, quote, a chronicler who recites events without distinguishing between major and minor ones acts in accordance with the following truth. Nothing that has happened should be regarded as lost for history, unquote. And it's all history, baby. What will happen might happen. What happened did happen. Something to ponder as the once mighty giants of capitalism, trains, planes, automobiles teeter and dwindle, and the stepchildren of surrealism topple statues in the parks. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program did not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
When I walk by this statue, it becomes very painful when I think of the suffering that my ancestors went through. And it should not be celebrated by these statues.